Good afternoon. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3 FM. In more than half of all African countries, homosexuality is illegal. Criminalization of homosexuality places same-sex practicing people at increased risk of contracting HIV, among other STIs. Increased vulnerability to HIV among same-sex practicing people is a function of a number of overlapping impacts of marginalization. Men who have sex with men are unable to address their sexual and reproductive health needs because they're misunderstood, under-researched, and ignored by mainstream interventions. They also face moral disapproval and stigma. As UNAIDS describes, discrimination prevents men who have sex with men from disclosing their sexual orientation or reporting for HIV services. Consequently, their vulnerability to infection is increased, and national data do not reflect the size of the HIV epidemic that is linked to same-sex behavior involving men. Because of criminalization in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, men who have sex with men actively avoid confrontation and are thus invisible to mainstream initiatives and services. Also because of criminalization, in many cases, men who have sex with men are unable to organize to fight government inaction, social marginalization, and lack of access to prevention tools such as condoms. Men who have sex with men are also increasingly vulnerable because of an absence of engagement with government due to mistrust and because avenues for dialogue are limited. One of the very important academics in this area is Professor Mark Eprecht, who's a professor at Queen's University, and he studies the history of men who have sex with men in Southern Africa. My good friend Sasha Dick from Health on Earth caught up with Professor Eprecht while he was in Montreal. On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we hear from Sasha and Professor Eprecht.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3. Dr.
Albrecht is a professor of history at Queen's University. He's written a book about the history of homosexuality in Africa, and his latest interest now has been how the rights around sexual identity have been incorporated into HIV/AIDS treatment across Africa. And he came and spoke today at the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies, and his talk was all about this this rights by covert means. So we're very lucky to talk to him just before his talk and find out more about what he's been thinking.
Right. Okay, so my name is Mark Eprecht, and I'm a professor in the Department of Global Development Studies at Queen's University. And what I do, well, I'm a historian, and lately, I guess since 1996, so that's been a project of mine to try and understand the history of same-sex sexuality in Southern Africa. That's how it started. So what types of relationships existed in the past, and how have those changed over time, and how have people understood them, the meanings attached to different types of relationships obviously have changed over time. And that was my project up until I published my book. It's called Hunkuchani in 2004. It kind of, the book really substantively ends in the, I guess, the 1980s, really. I left it off at that point, which was when a gay rights movement really got started in South Africa. And to a lesser extent, Zimbabwe, which was my base. I was teaching at the University of Zimbabwe at that time. And so I got that out there. I thought that was the end of it. You know, he'd publish and then he'd move on. But there was an interesting response. And the other thing is, it is kind of unavoidable if you live in southern Africa. You do start to notice young people disappearing, your colleagues, your students, what happened to them, Will. It's a disaster. And it doesn't matter what your background is, really. I mean, I'm a historian, but you do get drawn into debates around public health, no matter almost what you do. It's unavoidable if you have a heart. and so after the publication of that book, well, even before, I know I got increasingly involved in supporting the emergence of, I would call, a sexual rights network across Africa, and particularly in southern Africa. But since the late 90s, it's been taking off in other parts of the continent, including places where you'd be amazed because of civil war and poverty and whatever. But there are gay rights, or not necessarily calling themselves that way, groups emerging to make the equation between sexual rights, human rights, and public health.
And from a historical perspective, do you think the fact that this movement started in South Africa in the 80s could be linked to the anti-apartheid movement as a greater, as part of a greater fight for human rights in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. It started in South Africa for a number of reasons, but that's one of them. I mean, the very, very first, what could be called gay rights organizing, really goes back to the 60s. And sometimes there's an event that's sometimes called South Africa's Stonewall in 1966, so it's actually before Stonewall, which was a police raid on a private party. And that, in those days, it was a liberal, white, middle class, usually English speaking kind of movement. And that was a limiting factor for sure. It picked up in the struggle against apartheid. Yeah. There are many other factors that I think contributed to South Africa being at the forefront of this. One reason is that, notwithstanding this kind of stereotype of South Africa as, you know, a tyranny under apartheid, in actual fact, there were still independent state, well, institutions, courts, etc., that functioned somewhat free from the apartheid ideology and were venues where people could struggle for their rights. So even throughout the apartheid years, people had a space, and including in the media, to argue these things. And people looked internationally as well, probably more so than in a lot of other African countries.
Okay. Another question, I think the elephant in the room that you're describing when you talk about people disappearing is, of course, HIV/AIDS. And I wonder if you can make the link. You mentioned global health movements and the struggle for sexual freedoms also.
Well, that's kind of what I'm going to be talking about today, really. In a lot of Africa, including North Africa, there are laws which prohibit same-sex behavior, especially male-male. So very often those laws are directly inherited from the colonial period. And there has been a movement to challenge those, and that's going back, like in the case of South Africa, so that's the earliest. But other countries in Southern Africa, 80s, really picking up steam in the 90s and then spreading to other parts of Africa in the 2000s. And that movement has contributed to a backlash in a lot of African countries. But at the same time, and so, you know, you have these stories like what's been recently happening in Uganda and Nigeria. Malawi has got, you know, that case of that trans couple there recently. Yeah, so there's been a lot of backlash from the top levels of political elites, religious leaders, who try to portray this emerging gay rights or sexual rights network as a Western cultural imperialism kind of thing. So, yes, there's been that backlash, and it has driven some people into the closet or into exile. But it's also stimulated interest in the questions, you know, like, for example, when I was in Zimbabwe in the 90s, so HIV/AIDS in mid-90s was really taking off. And the way it was perceived at that time was mostly a black and straight phenomenon, right? So Mugabe starts making these speeches about same-sex sexuality as being a Western cultural import and, you know, a danger to the nation. And a lot of people responded at the time by saying, you know, look, you know, we don't want to hear this, and we're embarrassed our president is talking about this. But on the other hand, he did raise the profile of this organization that was there in Zimbabwe, GALS, Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe. So a lot of people had never heard of it before. So in a sense, he raised the profile, got it into the public debate, and the numbers of especially young black men joining the organization grew a lot. And they became quite active, connecting the issue of sexual rights to health. And so it became pretty obvious that the stereotype of HIV/AIDS as a straight, you know, heterosexual intercourse only, which a lot of gay people bought into that too at the time, and they actually saw themselves as practicing safer sex, right? Because it just wasn't on the agendas, and everyone's talking about heterosexual intercourse as the biggest danger. So a lot of people saw themselves as actually practicing safer sex, the male-male, even anal intercourse. So, but then people began to notice, actually, there are a lot of young gay men are dying here. So something is happening, and we need to talk about it more. We need to develop our own counseling services and education and protect our people, because the state is obviously not going to do it in the Zimbabwe case. So a lot of the activism in the late 90s was focused, and early 2000, even today, is focused on educating often gay identified or homosexually identified, but in practice also often bisexual, because in a context like in Zimbabwe, you need to hide your sexual orientation by having a girlfriend or getting married. So, that's the connection there is very strong.
And I wonder if also part of contributing, or another contributing factor to this growing same-sex identity, is also the messages around HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, the messages around HIV/AIDS, well, it's changing a lot, but to give you an anecdote, when I was in Zimbabwe in the 80s, so it was just appearing, it was kind of a joke. And at that time, it was seen as a Western thing, a gay, white thing. And so it just wasn't taken seriously. So that's 80s. So in the 90s, I went back, and by that time, I had kids with me. And one of them was in, what is it, grade one or two, and they did a play of all the diseases, right? So the kids got dressed up as different diseases. And some kid was dressed up as HIV. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. They're getting the message out to the kids really young, right? So I went to the teacher after, and I said, you know, congratulations. I see this progress that's happened here, and you're educating the kids about HIV, because, you know, by the 90s, we're talking seroprevalence of, you know, 20% among adults, if not more. And so I thought, this is a great thing. And she just, you know, looked really embarrassed and said, well, don't worry. We don't tell them how they get it, right? So they're being educated that there's this horrible monster out there, but no other messages, right? So actually, is this helpful? I didn't really think so. Campaigns to educate people about HIV have been very half-hearted, in a sense. You know, they don't, until recently, and still in a lot of African countries, they don't talk about the full range of human sexuality. And it's not just homosexuality. They haven't talked about heterosexual anal intercourse. They scarcely talk about masturbation. I mean, all these things are just not on the agenda. And not to blame people, you know, of course there's cultures that have to be respected and this and that, but how can you have a holistic approach to the problem when you're leaving out select pieces of the puzzle? And particularly in Southern African, and not just, since then I've traveled fairly widely in West Africa and East Africa, it's the same story really. Because the culture is so disapproving of overt expressions of same-sex sexuality, or even overt expressions of heterosexuality is also disapproved. You know, kissing in the street would be considered a scandal, for example, and holding hands, often that thing, kind of thing is just, you know, it's just not done. It's not discreet. That's the same, it's the same I've encountered in Nigeria and Tanzania and Uganda and South Africa. So you just can't talk about these things because of fear of retribution, extortion, etc. So what you do is you hide your sexual preference behind. In the case of men, they would have a girlfriend or multiple girlfriends to show the world that they're straight, or get married. And that's and it's not always just like that. Maybe sound like a cynical plan. I mean, people actually want to get married because of the other benefits, and not just economic, but spiritual and all this. So there isn't that same kind of presumption that, okay, if I realize I'm gay, oh, that means I have to become 100% gay all the time and I have to perform this. That wasn't there so much. So people are hiding their sexual preferences behind this facade of normalcy, in a sense. So it actually, it's a big danger, I mean, to the whole population. So we're not just talking like it's a sexual minority that's killing themselves off, as sometimes, you know, people say that's a good thing, they, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and all that. But these are often men who are having relationships with men, going home to their wives, and it's not like they're spreading HIV necessarily so much that way. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a medical scientist, but it seems to me there's an indirect threat here that's not being talked about very much. So the men are having anal sex with each other, and of course HIV is not necessarily so infective, but other sexually transmitted diseases are. So then they go home and they have sex with their wives, and their wives then are hugely imperiled by this, right? So it's kind of indirect ripple effect of this hidden culture, right? So I think what's happened in the last few years is at the level of donors and sort of ministers of health, they're starting to wake up to this. And of course, the gay rights associations, such as they are, have been arguing for this. They start by, you know, focusing on protecting each other and their own little networks. But they've been trying to link up with other groups, feminist groups and other human rights groups, to make the case that it's not just them as a little minority that's in danger, but this is a bigger issue for the whole society. And my view is now that is starting to get picked up. For example, The Lancet, for the first time, I think it was 2009, they published an article that basically said, maybe we were wrong for the last 25 years. You know, so they had definitively said in 1986 that this is a heterosexual pandemic. Right, so they ruled. There's one article I read. It wasn't in The Lancet, but it was a very prominent medical scientist who said, quite frankly, you know, there's only three modes of transmission in Africa. So it's not like he said male transmission is not very important or it's small. He said there is none, right? And that's a big mistake. So 2009, The Lancet finally recognized, after 25 years, that maybe something is going on here that we need to do the research on, and that's been happening, actually. Some quite big studies of men who have sex with men but do not identify as gay or bi, or and finding out what their practices are and how to educate them about the risks.
Do you see that it's possible that through that public health approach, that is then a way of also creating or talking about these identities, these sexual identities, and perhaps creating names for them and labels that people wouldn't have thought of otherwise?
Yeah, so that's a debate that's going on, and it's not by any means settled. There are some very strong voices in Africa, including in places like Uganda, which take the view that we can't put health as the number one thing. We have to put rights first. And they're not going to go the health route because for many reasons. I mean, who wants to be identified as a public health risk? As they're, they don't want to come out as a danger to the wider society and to be a kind of, to have themselves conceptualized as a health risk. They want to come out as human beings with a rich life and dignity that everyone else should have. So that's one kind of extreme, if you will, that perhaps comes closest to the Western gay rights model. So they're there, even in a context like Uganda, on the ground fighting against this state and church-backed homophobia. But there's others, and interestingly, the neighboring country, countries, both Kenya and Tanzania, and I have no explanation for this, but I was at a conference recently where there were people from all three countries, and I have no idea, but the Ugandans were much more radical in that gay rights kind of way, whereas the Kenyans and the Tanzanians were very much into, let's take the public health route, because if we come out, we're going to get slapped down real bad. So this way, we'll sort of get our foot in the door. People will start talking about it. It will become normalized, you know, in a sense. And then we can do the right thing. So it's a strategic question, and I think people are sensitive to what's happening on the ground, what's the political context. So it's quite diverse. I wouldn't want to say there's any agreement. I was at a conference just in November in Cape Town, which brought people together from all over, and that's one of the themes, is how are we going to fight this emerging homophobia? And yeah, people were torn. Let's do the rights thing, but can we trust our states to... They can promise on paper, but you know, as soon as the West isn't looking, or as soon as civil society in some countries is attenuated, the state can say whatever it wants and then smack you down, right? So so for a lot of people, taking the public health route is safer and could be, even in the short run, more effective at getting the rights message out there.
Okay, so to quickly summarize, it sounds like there are different Pan-African movements towards greater acceptance of same-sex behaviors and identities, but in each country and context, it's taking a different route, some more radical with a human rights perspective, and others taking kind of a side road through health and talk about HIV/AIDS to then therefore propose the idea of same-sex people and get it accepted by the population. And depending on political context, people are taking different tacks.
Yeah, it's pretty diverse right now, and it's not predictable. You know, sitting in North America looking over, you might think, okay, we hear it's really bad in Nigeria, but, you know, there's a lot of things happening there. You'd be surprised. There's a very active Christian church, which is gay-friendly and has quite open ambition to convert people, right? That's the way they even put it, you know, which is exactly feeding into the propaganda of the state, you know, but in a sense, they're making fun of it. They're not intending to convert people per se, you know, but they are putting out the welcome mat. They want to educate people that, you know, this is a fact. It's been here in Nigeria for a long, long time, but just hidden, right? And now the time is appropriate. Even if this culture was great and worked for everybody 100 years ago, or even 50, or even 20 years ago, you know, times have changed, right? And these kind of traditional closets that were there, a lot of people are getting tired of them because, you know, of so many factors, extortion, police corruption, violence that is often there. The fact that there's this demagoguery that distracts from the real issues in the country that have to be dealt with, you know, targeting tiny visible minorities in Zimbabwe. When I was there, there was a maximum 100 people in the country of 12 million who were out, you know, in the gays. So having the president denounce this little group over and over and over again, you know, people can see through that as a cheap political trick. So, yeah, times are changing, and each country has a different level of comfort with these discourses. And like I said, it's really surprising. You think everyone says South Africa, you know, is the cutting edge of these debates, and to some extent it is. But you know, the president right now is pretty ambivalent on these issues, and South Africa has not come out to strongly defend people who are suffering from abuses by the state in, say, Malawi or wherever. They haven't spoken up, you know, in diplomatic language, and they haven't signed on with the UN General Assembly. Passed a resolution last year, I think it was, which included sexual orientation among the list of universal human rights. That was a French initiative. 66 countries signed up. South Africa was not one of them. That's very curious. But there were six other African countries that did. And, you know, you would never guess which one, like Central African Republic. So what are they doing? Now, some people would say, okay, that could be the French pressured them. And it's, if people want to dismiss this, they could say that's another example of Western imperialism trying to promote, you know, this concept of gay rights. But, yeah, anyway, sorry.
Well, on that topic, do you have any inkling that perhaps the backlash is also a product of Western imperialism? Certainly in Uganda, we see the great influence of the Christian fundamentalist right, American pastors going over and doing a lot of the ghostwriting of this anti-gay bill, as it's known there, and doing a lot of promotion of this kind of hatred. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that is true. And now I'll say that because I haven't done the research myself, but anecdotally, I've heard so many stories of this happening. And there have been a few studies which have tracked the activities of some of these, I would have to describe them as fundamentalist Christian missionary initiatives in places like Uganda, and it's popular, you know, and that's the thing. People are suffering because of economic hard times, and they're turning to these really simplified messages that you do this, 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 and you'll actually be rewarded, not in heaven somewhere, but in this world, you'll be rewarded materially. That some of these evangelical churches are quite, if you ask me, quite crude in that message. And it's attracting people a lot. Why Americans are going to Uganda to sell this? Well, I think my theory is that it's pretty discredited in North America, but maybe not. Maybe they could still sell these ideas in small towns or rural areas. I don't know, but really, it's not going to fly in the courts and whatever. So they've lost that battle, especially if we talk about Canada.
Mark, thank you so much for coming by. Really appreciate talking to you. Do you have any final words that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, no final words, except maybe just to say, don't take the sensationalized stories that come in the press about the atrocities and homophobia that you hear from Africa. Things are more complicated. There's a lot of really positive things happening on the ground, and I'm optimistic that these issues will be resolved in a way that promotes a culture of human rights and sexual health.
That was Sasha Dick from Health on Earth in Montreal interviewing Mark Epricht, who's a professor in the Department of History at Queen's University. That's all we've got for today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective. You can find us online at healthjusticeradio.wordpress.com. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll catch you next week.
Stop it. it's how it was. I thought that we were fine. Then the day was night. You were high when I was doomed and dying for with no light, with no light. It made me love.